Israel's annexation plans that they did not find it in their interest. We also saw a tremendous amount of opposition from U.S. Congress. And in fact, for Israel, this it's more of the same because they already exercise de facto annexation over those lands. What it would have advanced and would have changed for Israelis is the fact that Netanyahu would have been playing to his right-wing base, that he was able to secure annexation during his tenure. But the reality on the ground doesn't change. This doesn't avert the takeover of those lands. If the UAE actually wanted to make a meaningful concession for Palestinians, it would have been withdrawal of Israeli troops from the Jordan Valley, at the very least, which is only 30% of the West Bank, let alone withdrawal from the entire occupied territories, and in fact, the right of return for Palestinian refugees. This leaves so much for want. And all of it is doublespeak and mirrors and shadows when they say that there are any meaningful concessions. We'll probably see Israel advance their interests and actually enact de jure annexation, notwithstanding this agreement.
Noor Erekat, we want to thank you so much for being with us, Palestinian human rights attorney and legal scholar. We'll link to her piece, Trump Peace Deals for Israel, UAE, and Bahrain Are Shams. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
This is KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring a program director to manage our programming department. This full-time position requires proven experience in program directing, radio audio production, management, and supervisory skills with volunteers, with an emphasis on teamwork and a collaborative setting, and the ability to work under strict deadlines. KBOO Community Radio is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. The deadline to apply for this position is Saturday, October 3rd. More information can be found at kboo.fm/employment.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO Portland, your community connection. It's a little after 8 a.m. It's Wednesday morning. It's time for the Wednesday Morning Talk Radio Show with your host, Paul Rowland. Stay tuned.
Good morning, everybody. This is Paul Rowland talking at you from my home in Southeast Portland. This is Community Radio, and we are going to be talking about a complex and heavy-duty subject that we are all immersed in at this very moment. Except if you're further away and listening on the internet, you know that we are in the middle of a unprecedented firestorm, and we are breathing its smoke. And I am going to be speaking with former firefighter Tim Inglesby, and I'll introduce him in a minute. But first, I want to talk a little bit about KBOO. We are in our extended late summer fall membership drive, and we depend on you, the listener, hopefully the member of our community project, to support us in our ongoing efforts to bring you the truth behind the general lies and manipulations, especially fomented by our current liar in chief. Anyway, so we are not having our regular phone line where we have it set up in the back room at KBOO with very lively scene with lots of telephones and volunteers and people interacting. Oh, we are in the middle of a pandemic, and so we have to change our plans accordingly. But through the ability of technology to make things easier, you can go to our website, kboo.fm, and find out all about how to support us, the various ways you can do that. We are obviously looking for your financial support. That's how we keep our staff paid, our electricity bill paid, our translators functioning, and all that. But we're also looking for some new members and just spreading the word. You know, if you can't support us financially right now, social media exists. Let's use it. Mention us on Facebook and the other social media. Talk us up. Tell people why you listen to KBOO. Talk about what programs you like on KBOO. Recommend, post the programs. Every program on KBOO is its own podcast. You can go to our website, kbo.fm, and you can click on any program and you can post it on social media or email it, however you want to do it. Just do it. Spread the word. We need to combat this massive idiocy on the internet that is saying things like Antifa is our arsonists and lighting these wildfires. It's idiocy, but it's dangerous idiocy, and so we need to use whatever power we can through our direct terrestrial airwaves, which you may be listening to me on right now, or, as I said, social media or other, whatever means. So talk us up, please. Support us if you can financially. Send a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Or again, go to kbo.fm/give/donate. All right, that's what I got to say about that. So let's talk about Tim Inglesby. He's a co-founder and executive director of Firefighters United for Safety, Ethics, and Ecology. And as a faculty research associate at the University of Oregon, he began his career as a wildland firefighter for the U.S. Forest Service and National Park Service. In 1993, he received the Oregon Conservationist of the Year Award by Oregon Natural Resources Council. He co-founded and directed the Cascadia Fire Ecology Education Project from 1994 to 2004, and created and directed the Western Fire Ecology Center from 1997 to 2004. He's a senior wildland fire ecologist certified by the Association for Fire Ecologists. He is an ideal person to take a deep dive into the many facets of, as I said, the firestorm that has beset us. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Paul.
How are you doing this morning? How's the smoke down there in Eugene?
It's a lighter shade of gray, better than it was, darker shade of brown. And my apologies if I got a little gravelly voice, sniffly nose, and sore throat. I'm sure many people are suffering along with me. It does harken back to the days when I was, ground pounder on the fire lines and inhaling a lot of these forests.
Well, that's the first thing I kind of wanted to start off because, obviously, the news media and our politicians are hailing, rightfully, the firefighters who are out there fighting these hellish blazes as heroes, who are doing their utmost to try to prevent greater damage, to try to prevent loss of life and people's houses and livelihoods. But you were actually in the thick of it. We're smelling, what people in urban areas have pretty much never had to deal with before, up and down the West Coast. But as you said, you were in the thick of it. Talk about a little bit what it was like.
So, sure. But first, my heart goes out to all those who have lost everything, lost loved ones, lost their homes, have had their, communities evacuated, their lives uprooted. My heart really goes out to them. And those who are on the front lines, engaged with the fire, they've been at it a long time. And The crews are really beat up, very fatigued. In addition to the normal stresses of being out there, you know, and the heat and the smoke, you've got to deal with this COVID crisis too, which is another stress on the firefighters themselves and their friends and family. You know, it's a big pall of, you know, anxiety, fear, and depression. We just have to kind of slog our way through.
Continue along those lines. Before, you know, you talk about your personal experience and how you got started. Have you been hearing from people who are actually fighting the fires and what they're experiencing?
Oh yes. Earlier this year, there were a lot of concerns about the health and safety protocols for COVID, but that is kind of a story that hasn't been told, that we're doing much better than many people feared in terms of the spread of COVID through firefighters. Uh-huh. Just the nature of the job makes firefighters very susceptible to, you know, catching the virus, and if catching the virus, getting severely ill or worse. And so it seems that we're doing better with the protocol that was set up, you know, dispersing crews to smaller spike camps instead of these large mini cities in the woods that used to be the norm. People kind of isolating as a crew, as a family unit, you know, module of one, they call it, and instead of, you know, mixing in large mess halls for meals and things. So, but it's still the nature of the job is enormously taxing on the body. You're dealing with smoke inhalation, sleep deprivation, arduous labor, poor sanitation, and I'm not sure what the quality of the food is these days either. I think they're eating a lot of combat rations instead of hot meals. So it's just, you take a young, strong body, otherwise healthy, and put them through that hour after hour, and then they work, you know, up to 16-hour days, day after day, week after week, and you know, it has a general decline in your health. And that's what was my experience as a 20-something firefighter. I was very physically fit and strong, and by the end of the season, I was just wasted. And very typically, I would lose my sense of smell and taste for weeks or even months afterwards. It was slow to come on. Just chronic bronchitis every winter, you know, in Oregon's winter, west side winter climate, it goes on and on. So some of the symptoms of just normal health degradation from wildland firefighting also resemble COVID. And so it's pretty tough here. Mm-hmm. And my heart goes out to the crews in line as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we could talk about go in so many directions. Obviously, I start thinking about long-term health consequences, which you've sort of started to indicate. We can maybe talk about that further on. But let's just get right into the meat of these actual fires. I heard you on Democracy Now, which is really great. You're really getting out there, which is really important to hear voices like you when there's so much misinformation, disinformation, lack of information, ignorance about the nature of wildfires, the changing nature of wildfires. The term unprecedented is being used more and more and more. And you told me yourself when we talked a couple days ago that you were just blown away by the magnitude. Maybe start by talking about that, just the number and extent of the wildfires that are hitting us.
Yeah, that is almost an annual ritual by the news media. The hype and hysteria, the sensationalism, the record-breaking wildfire season. And historically, it's just not true. There used to be far more fire on the land before Euro-American colonization settlement. And probably our summers were generally smoky every year. It's just not this smoky.
And not smoke from toxic, you know, burning plastic and whatever else.
Absolutely. It's very bad smoke there. It wasn't the disaster that it is now, because the native peoples that had learned to live with and coexist with, even thrive with, fire on the land. And particularly here in the Willamette Valley, the Kalapuya had what you might call a pyroculture. It was just centered around fire for many uses, helped cultivate the plants and animals and habitats that made their civilization thrive for 10,000 years or more, even through periods of climate change, natural climate, variability. So somehow that's been lost on Western, white society. They just you look at this past century of trying to exclude fires, encircle and extinguish any fire on the landscape and remove it from the ecosystem is really a complete anomaly to what has really been part of our human nature, as the one and only species on the planet that has this knowledge and ability to use fire. We alone can start fires, and we alone are probably crazy enough to try to stop all fires. And acknowledging the vital ecological role of fire is a tough message right now. People are suffering from this perception we have an overabundance of fire. Well, it's not so much an overabundance, it's more a kind of maldistribution. We're getting the wrong kinds of fire in the wrong places, times, and conditions, not enough of the right kinds of fire in the right times, places, and conditions. And the wrong places for fire are in our communities, in our homes. The right places for fire are in these wildland native ecosystems. And so somehow we have to kind of separate these, you might call them two kinds of fires. Fires belong in the forest, but fires do not belong in our homes. And so I'm looking forward to that kind of discussion of how do we, deal with one and live with the other.
And of course, the question comes up, which I actually heard extended conversation about on NPR this morning, which was encouraging, which is the extension of human habitation deep into these wildlands, and the extension of the so-called wildland or rural and urban interface, the urgency to stop these fires that are out there because the protection of human habitations, and then the idiocy just like the building on floodplains and the rise in increased intensity of hurricanes and flooding events parallel to the rise of the intensity of wildfires due to the drought and increased heat conditions, and the building where they people shouldn't be building, and the difficulty of discouraging that in the kind of society we live in. Anyway, there's so many directions to go, and that's one of them. Talk a little bit then. Okay, from a firefighter's, you can respond to that as you wish, but also from a firefighter's perspective, maybe talk about your experience in being out there and sort of the differences in fighting fires where there's human habitations around and not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I have this wealth of experience in wildland firefighting. I was just I had many varied experiences being on 20 person, fire crews and engine crews and a hell attack crew member. I wasn't a smoke jumper, wasn't that crazy, but I really ate it up. I very gung ho. my naivety as a 20 something year old, that's how I came out west. I was hired by the Forest Service to become a wildland firefighter in Oregon National Forest. And I had absolutely no prior knowledge or experience in it. I had a work study job in my college back east building outdoor ice skating rinks using fire hoses. So, you know, I could screw two ends of a hose together, and that was all I needed to be, you know, sent out on the lines. And, this summer is really bringing back some memories long forgotten of what we called the Siege of 87. In 1987, a whole string of lightning fires came up the Sierra Nevada and the Southern Cascades, California, and the last fire was the Silver Fire down in the Siskiyou National Forest. And all other crews and resources had already been dispatched to California. They were out slogging at it. And we were the last stop here in Oregon. And my 20-person fire crew was one of the first crews of it was typed to arrive there. They didn't even know what to do with us, because there were tens of thousands of acres on fire already. We just drove up to a Bear Pass road, and they just told us to watch it. Well, you know, here I am on my shovel, panning the horizon, and the whole world was on fire. It's a sea of smoke with just the highest buttes poking up like islands. And that was a real epiphany, and like, wait a minute, we are just mere humans, mortal at that, dealing with a very big and powerful force of nature. What are we really expecting to be able to do? And I was there the whole summer. And that fire in particular was off the charts in terms of its smoke emissions. And you could barely see a few hundred feet. It was mostly a ground show. Helicopters, air tankers couldn't see through that smoke. And so it's just endlessly, you know, going at it. Some afternoons when the inversion would lift, you get more winds, the fire kick up, and we run away. You know, it was big, wild country, and wildfire, and we were just really doing what we could. But it wasn't until the weather changed, the winters came, that fire was finally, you know, out. And but the impacts lasted especially the smoke impacts lasted with me for a long, long time. And I'm just remembering that summer in particular, it was kind of an echo, you know, today in the situation. We had just massive lightning storms all over, big fire, spreading fire, way beyond the kind of resources and crews that we could have to engage the fire. And you know, eventually the winter rains will come, snow will fall, fires will go out, and you know, at that point it will be, I think, more people will be open to a kind of rational discussion of what happened and where we go from here. Right. Mm-hmm. Now it's very difficult to have that kind of discussion where people are still, you know, fearful and lots of stress and lots of trauma. And, you know, some people, if you lost their homes, they don't know where to go. With COVID, it's even scarier. So, you know, it makes this kind of discussion very challenging. Mm-hmm. And things that must be said often can't be heard because of just the, you know, situation we're in. But I appreciate this opportunity, Paul, and, you know, talk with you
those are very wise words that kind of need to sort of start out the conversation from a basis of really understanding how, for me, you've been there, but me and no doubt the large majority of the listeners haven't been there. We're here basically cooped up in our houses, both because of COVID and because of this incredible dense smoke, and basically getting our information from, you know, the media. Yeah. And sort of, you know, responding. You know, I've been on these stupid, you know, climate change free-for-all Facebook groups trying to, I don't know, probably uselessly trying to combat these ridiculous, you know, it's a you know, these flame wars that I don't know if it's useful or not, but you see all the stuff that's out there, and some of it, you know, some of it in, some coming from, or certainly going to some of those communities that are impacted by these fires, which is exacerbating. So yeah, you've got the civil war or culture war or whatever going on with a Trump presidency. You've got COVID. You've got a lot of stuff. So yeah, we do need to try to navigate our way through this. Yet right. persevere we must.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Let me just put that question back to you. That so you got all these fires going on right now. You know, in Oregon from north to south, we've got the Riverside, we've got the Beachy Creek, we've got all these fires going on. And you mentioned that, let me just kind of recapitulate. You talked about the history of fire within indigenous culture as being something that was both, you know, part of the culture and part of the landscape, and something that sort of was almost like a co-evolutionary adaptation, I guess. I don't know if that's strictly speaking scientifically accurate, but it certainly lasted for thousands of years. And you've got this totally different, which has sort of scrambled everything up. And you've got this, you know, fire suppression. You've got, you know, fires that are happening in the wrong place at the wrong time. But nevertheless, there is something different about these fires. There is something.
Yeah.
There's a drought. We've been having serious drought. I know right here in Portland, it's been, you know, we've had like a month or more than a month of no appreciable rain. It's eerie. It's very.
Yeah.
It's a sign of the changing climate right here right now. Anyway, so yeah, I could go on and on with this long-winded question, but you talk about you know your reaction to what's actually going on the ground with the fires.
Yeah, well, I like I say every summer, it's kind of depressing how the media just over sensationalizes fires, and that's what the majority of people, that's what they know about wildfires, is what they see on TV or read in the papers. It's a very distorted image of what's going on out there in the backcountry. Today, the dominant image of wildfire are burning homes and incinerated communities. Is that a wildfire? In my mind, that's an urban fire. And that is really the kind of the main issue, the main worry, is when wildfires and wildlands enter into and transition into urban fires in, you know, suburban rural neighborhoods and communities. And one thing about this year, with all these fires screaming down from the mountains, down our valleys into the Flint Valley itself, that was shocking even to me. It's so many wet side, big fires, explosively spreading, tens of thousands of acres, several miles per day. I mean, that is a natural phenomenon in some places, and we can expect, you know, a few fires like that scattered across the West, but never region-wide do we have such a, you know, this upsurge of big fires moving fast, threatening so many people here on the West Side. And, you know, here, you know, my son works about a few blocks away from an evacuation zone. You know, I've had the past week with my car half packed, ready to, you know, evacuate myself. If one thing is a kind of wake-up call, we're all living in the fire zone, even those of us living in the middle of the cities, because particularly the destructive fires, you know, that have really devastated Phoenix and Talent and Blue River and Mill City and Detroit. Once one home ignites, it always sets up a kind of chain reaction, a domino effect of house-to-house ignition. So I live in the flatlands here in the middle of Eugene, but it's, you know, a few blocks away, a house catches fire, is just 10 feet away from its neighbor's house, and so it's way beyond the ability of firefighters to protect hundreds of homes threatened simultaneously by a single wildfire. It just takes one weak link in that chain to really set it up. So that's the problem that I think, and the real fear of people is losing their lives, losing their homes, their communities, and that essential infrastructure. And I don't want to be dismissive, but this is such a dumb problem to have, because we know how to build homes that are relatively fireproof. We've done it in the big cities of the East, which had huge fires, the Chicago Fire, for example. Well, that was the last time they built their, inner city out of wood. They converted to materials, they built the infrastructure, they established municipal fire crews. They just don't have those kinds of big fires in big cities back east. But out here in the West, We built our civilization.
It's because we were in a huge forest with big trees that were easy to get, and so it was cheap material. Yeah, for sure.
Exactly.
Well, that's a whole question then. How to not only regear or whatever our infrastructure to be more fuel efficient, energy efficient. But also how to, obviously that, I feel relatively safe in my neighborhood, although I don't know, you start talking about the names of communities, from Estacada to my house, there's, a whole series of communities, some of which were actually under level 2 evacuation orders, like Happy Valley, which is really not that many miles away. I mean, so, I don't want to be sanguine, but it does feel relatively safe, but not that far from what you're talking about. So that's a big question. Is obviously, in wildlands there are now in a lot of areas, you have to have a metal roof and stuff. Of course, there's probably a lot of grandfather clauses where people don't have that, which is a serious problem. And obviously, people are going to be taking that a hell of a lot more seriously. Again, what you said initially is we've got to, some people might be listening who did lose their home, and it's a terrible thing. I know people who lost their home. We know people. Yeah. I knew people who were involved in, the forest movement back in the day who lost their home and had to, barely escape. They were, in the river on a log for, 6 hours or something. And finally, there's some amazing stories out there, and then there's people we know, like Georgia Tia, who may not have made it out, who, was largely responsible for saving one of the most amazing forests left, Opal Creek. But we could talk about that some. And then, Breitenbush, where I started my activism, climbed a tree, naive me, 20-something, in 1986, and had an amazing experience. And there's an amazing story there about a couple people from the community who stayed against, maybe foolishly, but they actually ended up saving some of the historic structures of Breitenbush. So hopefully it will live on. So there's just so many stories, obviously, they're going to come out, some of which I linked to on my program page. Mm-hmm. I think I've already lost myself where we started out. But what were you saying, Tim?
Well, let me address a little bit of that, because I was also a forest activist back in the 1980s and 90s. Actually, I still am a forest activist. And in particular, on the Silver Fire, I went to some wild country. I don't think many two-leggeds besides Sasquatch really roam. It was amazing to be out there, engaging fire and just amazing wild country. I believe that was 100,000 acres, the Silver Fire, about that. It was off the scale at that time, 1987. 1987, by the way, was the year that climatologists kind of mark as the signal of climate change you know, being registered in terms of wildfire activity. 1988, we had the Yellowstone fires, and that was like, wow, that was an amazing event. And just every year, like the global average temperature keeps rising, it seems like the upsurge in wildfire activity keeps
rising. But talk a little bit more. What was the reason for them designating, like the intensity, the extent? What was...
Well, they measure it in the area burned or acres burned,
uh-huh. Okay.
Which is really not that significant because today I think there's maybe 3 million acres on fire in California. Well, historically, every year there was over 4 million acres burned in California. You know, it's just naturally, but you know, in the Siskiyou, you know, being exposed to that amazing place, over the years it was threatened by numerous timber sales, and I was part of that movement that defended the wild Siskiyou. I'm very proud of that, and we kept a lot of trees standing that otherwise might be big stumps. And then came in 2002 the Biscuit Fire, 500,000 acres on fire, completely reburned the old Silver Fire. And I, you know, it's like, oh my God, all those trees I, you know, helped save from saws just got destroyed by fire. Well, even that is not true. It's a different, you know, yeah, many trees were killed. Trees are killed by fire, but forests are often born in fire and thrive from fire. And those who are kind of, you know, mourning right now, you know, what happened to Opal Creek? You know, what happened to the beautiful forest around Brighton Bush? I just, you know, want to try to dispel some of that fear, because unlike fires entering, you know, burning homes and communities, that is utter destruction. Those are really tragic. Fires burning in wild forests are a different kind of animal, a different kind of fire. And particularly these big fires, they've spread so fast. The fire east of Eugene, the Holiday Farm fire, it was skipping, you know, ridgetop to ridgetop and just shooting ahead. That is the real issue of what's happening, that these climate-driven wildfires, is not that they're just so intense, giant tsunamis of flame rolling across the landscape, destroying everything in their path. That's just not what's happening out in the wildlands. It's very spotty. The embers are, you know, being lofted and landing a mile or two ahead of the flame front. And so they're kind of hopscotching across the landscape. That's why crews just can't engage them. They can't get out far enough or fast enough ahead of them to stop the spread. They're just, you know, romping across the land. But in that kind of hopscotching, you know, behind the lines, if you will, they're huge unburned areas or really lightly burned areas. And it's very, very mixed of intensities and severities and effects. And that is actually one of the ecological benefits of wild land fire. It's the pyrodiversity. It's a major agent in biodiversity. It creates a lot of rich habitats. That's very different than when fires enter communities and it just is like total destruction. I mean, even then there's some, you know, this house randomly survived and all the other neighbors, you know, were felled. Some of that occurs as well, but it is destruction in cities, and it is often rejuvenation in wildlands. And so somehow we gotta separate in our minds, you know, these two kinds of fires. Wildland.
Tim, I gotta. Huh?
Yeah.
No, wildland and urban, as you say. No, that's a crucial point. Let me just interrupt you for a second. We're already well past halfway through. This is KBOO Community Radio. This is Wednesday Talk Radio on KBOO. I'm Paul Rowland, the regular weekly host, and I'm talking with Tim Inglesby, who's director of Firefighters United for Safety Ethics, and ecology, which we probably should talk a little bit about, but you were a longtime wildland firefighter as opposed to an urban firefighter, although to some extent they're becoming a little blurred, yeah, because you've got crews that are having to probably enter into closer to, or at least try to stop them from entering into the, they're getting closer to that interface as you said, these fires are sometimes getting faster because, yeah, of, we're going to have to talk about the drought conditions. We're going to have to talk more about climate change, mm-hmm, as we go along, because we only have 20 minutes left. This is a call-in show. The number to call in is 503-231-8187. I also have a Facebook page, KBOO Wednesday Talk Radio. You can hit me up there. And you better get him in now, because it's, like I said, we're already going on two-thirds of the way through, and we've got a lot to talk about. And I do want to remind people we're in our late summer fall membership drive here at KBOO Community Radio. Please help us out if you can. Please talk us up amongst your friends, colleagues, on social media. KBOO.fm is our website. You can go and click on the donate button. We survive on your support. We want to get more members. We want to have more people hear about what we're doing, because we think it's really important. So yeah, you talked about the patchwork nature is really important. One thing I just wanted to throw out, I think, is, say that again.
They call it a fire mosaic.
Fire mosaic. That's right. I forgot. I used to know that. Fire mosaic. But one thing that's important, and I mentioned that I've been responding perhaps futilely on these climate change Facebook groups to these loony but dangerous allegations of there is arson, of course. We know there's arson, so we're gonna have to talk about causation. But you know, the formula I've taken to respond, because I think it is important to respond to the extent we can, and not let them, just like it's important to stand up to the fascists who come into our towns and streets, it's important to combat this misinformation, whether it comes from QAnon or Trump or whoever. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so I say, you know, come on. There's the source, the immediate direct cause of the fire, which can be matches. Often lightning strikes can be power lines, can be a cigarette butt, can be a gasoline can, much less common than lightning or power lines. But there's a difference between the immediate cause and whether or not the fire actually takes off. So we're talking about, you know, pre-existing condition of the forest, whether it's, yeah, drought or heat. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, this year, I mean, the pump was primed for big fires, because we those of us on the west side, the wet side of the Cascades, we live in a temperate rainforest, and we've had we've been in the midst of a big drought, multi-year drought, you know, with a deficit of rain, especially a deficit of snow, and so all that vegetation that grows so well with lots of rain was very dry. And then we had heat waves, and in California, record heat waves, 130 degrees in the desert, and 121 degrees in Los Angeles, record historic heat waves. And then kind of almost freakish lightning storms, particularly in California, on the west side of the Coast Range. It's a rare event. Scattered ignitions all over the place. And then top it off, this massive east wind event, and east winds, winds that come from the Oregon Desert on up over the Cascades, they barrel down the west slope, and they're dry winds and very strong, sustained winds. Again, they're kind of natural weather phenomenon, but they're relatively rare, and they typically come later in the fall. And so this,
which is why the fire season is usually later. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. They're an annual event in Southern California. They call them the Santa Ana winds. but they have number of names: Diablo winds, Chinook winds, East winds. But you know, they're typically kind of isolated. They're just a small location, late in fall, high in the mountains. We have this region wide, and it's if you take a look at time lapse photography from satellites, the ignition of the fires and the smoke that generated across the whole western slope of Oregon, Lincoln City on the coast, you know, having a similar phenomenon. So the pump was primed for big, fast moving fires, and we had all the elements, and all it needed was an ignition. So they came from different sources. In Phoenix and Talent, outside of Ashland, it was an arsonist, and it wasn't an Antifa activist. It was apparently, you know, the suspect is some meth head, and
I thought that fire was a lesser fire after the bigger fire had already started from other sources, but. Anyway,
that was generated. That was generated, you know, right there on the edge of town. You know, that was okay. A forest fire. That was an urban fire.
Right, right.
But
okay.
It's conflated with all the forest fires because it happened
at the same time.
The Holiday Farm fire, East Eugene, was a downed power line, and those east winds, it was kicking down, a lot of dead limbs and branches. Normally those would come down with the winter rains. Well, they came down with the east winds and dry. And so that was a power line fire. And, that is the issue for California for sure. You know, some of the deadliest, most destructive fires in California were started by downed power lines. That's fairly exotic here in Oregon, but it's it's happening here too. And we really gotta think about our urban infrastructure, these power lines strung all across the landscape that are now just becoming more, prone to ignition, more flammable. And what work do that too, I think, is a very dumb problem to have. I just can't say it any better. California should be powered by rooftop solar, just enormous potential. They should not have these ginormous power lines, surging with electricity. Run all over the landscape. In Oregon, we've got other options too, for renewable energy or dispersed, decentralized energy systems that don't put the landscape and our communities at risk from power line fires.
And Jim, let me put you on hold for just another second here. We want to talk about climate fires, which is I think Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, has actually contributed something useful to the conversation and calling them climate fires. But we do have a caller who's been on the line for a while. We want to respect that.
Oh, good.
Camilo, you're on the line. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you very much. And I really can't thank you and Paul enough for this important information. And also thank you to Amy Goodman for having you on the other day. And happy birthday to Paul. So I'm going to volunteer for BARC. BARC is the organization that protects the Mount Hood Forest. And we're having a couple of campaigns. Of course, the usual timber sale campaign, which we've been successful in keeping for the past 20 years out of the forest. But the other important campaign is to update the U.S. Forest Plan. It's 30 years old. Law requires that it be updated every 15 minutes. I mean, every 15 years. And progress has been made in having some discussions is that the Forest Service is beginning to recognize that fires are endemic to the forest and helpful ecologically for the forest. And we want to bring this message out to the community so that they can support getting an update of the forest plan. And I would appreciate any recommendations from you about how to bring this message to the public.
That's right. I believe the forest near me, the Willamette National Forest, its forest plan dates back to 1990. And so that's way outdated. And back in that day, I think fire took up two whole pages of a several hundred page document. And all it said is that we're just going to put them all out. And over the, over a 10-year span, we're going to keep fires, you know, under, you know, I don't know, you know, X amount of acres. Well, the following year was the year of the Warner Creek fire, and they blew past that in one single fire. And so, and they just have not accounted for fire on the landscape, either as a natural phenomenon or as a, under the influence of climate change. And so, over the, that span of time, what is that, 30 years? You know, there have been innumerable timber sales. Many of them purported to be, you know, various fire prevention schemes. And it's just the worst thing to do in terms of dealing with wildfire is to do commercial logging that takes out the most fire resilient trees in the forest and leaves behind more flammable, you know, vegetation, not just from the logging slash left behind, but that exposing the soil, disturbing the soil, slamming logs, dragging them across slope, you know, produces you know, a response that the vegetation that comes in afterwards is far more flammable than a native forest. I want folks to be prepared for what they're going to see when the smoke clears, so particularly up the McKenzie Valley, you know, where you know, Blue River and Nimrod were devastated. What they'll see is bizarre images, ashen ruins of the community, mounds of ash with big green trees still green standing up above them, you know. And and then, you know, in the hills, you know, bordering the McKenzie River, you're going to see moonscapes that are the remains of the timber industry's tree farms that were clear cut and then planted, you know, with a densely stocked monocrop of fast growing conifers. Those were vaporized. And so it's almost going to be like reeling back in time, going back to the 1980s and 1990s, when those areas were first clear-cut, and it was ghastly, shocking. You know, this is a major recreational corridor, and they're just devastated. Well, it's all that green veneer covering those industrial timberlands are now stripped bare. So it's going to be quite devastating. And so unlike a natural or native forest that burns very in a mosaic pattern and has you know, many plants, you know, their seeds are in the soil, and all they need is a little burst of sun and ash and rain. Fire is a great recycler of nutrients. They'll be thriving there. A burn.
See, what you're saying is industrial logging was one of the causes of the imbalance in the fire regime, and it's certainly not the solution. So yeah. I think the nature of Camila's question was also like the importance, you know, I'm sure you had plenty of experience. We all had experience of, you know, commenting on timber sales in getting involved in the process. I think he's inviting people perhaps to get involved. There's some kind of public process for commenting on these forest plans. So what would you recommend to the Forest Service or the BLM or state forests private forest managers?
Well, you know, because industry lost a lot of its investments in all these tree farms, they're going to be insatiable in demanding access to public lands. They're going to want to log public lands. And they want to claim that, oh, these public forests burned and the trees are dead in certain places, so they're no good for owls and those other furry, feathery critters, but they're good for 2x4s, toilet paper, let's log them. So the public needs to brace themselves for that kind of, you know, mad lust for further looting of the landscape. And if the line from Trump on down is, you know, the problem with these fires is lack of forest management. Well, go look at the private lands that had the maximum forest management, and it would, and they're just completely vulnerable to fire, and they burn catastrophically. We can't do more of that, especially on public lands, which are the reserves for biodiversity. And really, these forests are nature's prime organ for sucking that carbon out of the sky and sinking it into the soil. So it's we really got to defend public forests, which where the majority of our old growth forests or ancient forests are still located, and hold on to those and not fall for that that line. But it's coming. The machine is already wound up, and many of our perhaps favored politicians who are really good on issues of war and peace and democracy can be very bad on force and falling.
Some things never change, do they, Tim?
Yeah, I know. So I'm seeing kind of let's do the time warp again. We're going to have the same old arguments about dead trees and salvage logging and fire hysteria in forests, when the most urgent need right now is that we prepare our communities, our homes and communities, to live in a fire environment. This has got to be a teachable moment, a wake-up call. We live in a fire environment, and though it's a verdant, dense, dank green scene in our forests most of the year, it too burns. And in fact, these ancient forests in Cascadia were born from the last big fire. And so fire belongs here, belongs in our forests. It does not belong in our homes, communities. And we should focus on that first. Each public tax dollar spent on some timber sale way in the hinterland, way up high in high elevation forests around Mount Hood, for example, is wasted money on so many levels that it should be better spent on preparing our homes and communities to live with fire. So I feel very strongly about that. And that has to be a kind of a public demand that we stop throwing more blood and treasure in this endless and escalating war on nature, and that we really, center our efforts in keeping people, their homes, communities safe.
So, Tim, we only have 5 minutes left. Well, we did have one caller. I don't know if he's still there. Let's see if George is there. Try to make it really quick.
Yeah, I'm here. Yeah, I just have a topic, and I'll be very brief. There was also a lot of town building, small towns, villages, really, along with the logging, and certain companies invested in the real estate, and they said, this is great. People have a place to live out in the wilderness, and we're making a bundle, but we're going to supply them with streets and all that. So I'd like to ask you guys if you care to comment on the economic dynamics under what we call capitalism of the spread of little towns in the great forest and elsewhere where they're very vulnerable. And I don't want to blame the capitalists. I want to blame a system that gets out of control. So thank you so much, and have a great day.
Okay.
Thank you. Yeah, well, we just, many people, have the homes and communities were built in fire-prone environments, and they did not realize that. Particularly post, in a couple decades after World War II, natural climate variability, we had kind of cooler, moister climate conditions. And that also enabled, firefighters to be very successful in putting out fires. So we would have, across the U.S., I'd say, 30 to 40 million acres burning from fire every year on average. 30 to 40 million acres right after World War II that crashed to about 3 to 4 million acres, a tenfold decrease. And it lulled people into a false sense of security that fire doesn't belong there. It's an exotic force, and that we are successful in putting it out. And so they built their homes with very flammable, materials and designs in very indefensible locations. And now, Now it's a wake-up call, and it's not like we have to remove people from where they live, because doesn't everyone want to live close to nature and live near the forest? But with relatively simple retrofits, we can greatly improve the survivability of homes in the event of fire.
Certainly in the rebuilding, because there's going to be a lot of rebuilding, because a lot of people lost everything. Mm-hmm. So I've been listening to various media, and it sounds like this has been something of a wake up call. A lot of stuff that's been put on hold for years. A lot of policy changes that have been talked about in terms of fire at the state level. Anyway, it sounds like there's some serious discussions going on. So I hope that's one of them. But that's a good place to end on. Those are really important words to hear, and we are pretty much out of time. I'll give you a last sentence if you have one. If not, we'll call it a show.
Well, that is the message of hope, and everyone should feel empowered. You don't need the government to give you approval to prepare your home and prepare your families and communities to live with fire, because fire is going to be here next year as well.
Okay. Thank you so much, Tim Inglesby. It's been a really stimulating conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Paul.
Okay. Bye-bye. This is Paul Rowland with Wednesday Talk Radio. Thanks to Sonia, board operator, and everybody else who's keeping KBOO going.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the CWC Walk-In Expungement Clinic on Friday, September 18th from 12 to 6 p.m. at the Northwest Cannabis Club in